My name is Mike Campbell, and I'm glad you're with me. Big changes this week, and it's not just the fallout from the government's reaction to the Omicron mutation. It's also the massive about-face by the Federal Reserve's Jerome Powell and U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, who finally admitted that, hey, inflation may not be transitory, won't be short-lived. In a moment, I'm going to talk to Michael Levy and then top analyst Kevin Muir, the macro tourist, about what it means for your investments. Plus, I'm going to get Kevin's take on where you should put your money. Also, stay with me for a truly shocking stat. I mean, after all, it's your tax dollars. Plus a good news, bad news, goofy award. And of course, I'll be joined by Victor Adair and Ozzy Jurek. But first, a quick comment. Increasingly, the division between those people who believe in free speech and the open exchange of ideas, even make that especially ones they disagree with, and those that favor censorship of certain points of view is arguably the most significant issue in society today, one that certainly fuels anger and exacerbates other divisions in society. I mean, there's no one who's participated in what's called the cancel culture who doesn't understand that. They understand that it stokes anger, exacerbates divisions in society, but for them, it's not a bug, it's a feature. They believe that those that don't 100% adhere to their agenda have no place in society, at our universities or our public schools or the mainstream media. For example, you remember when David Suzuki, and he said it on more than one occasion, said that politicians who don't agree with him on climate change should be thrown in jail. Well, that's no different from the cancel culture mob saying that those that don't adhere to their agenda shouldn't have a job or a place in society. Now, personally, I believe in free speech, even things I don't agree with. No, I believe it. But the evidence suggests that I'm in a shrinking minority. Our politicians, the media, educational establishment never tire of declaring their commitment to diversity. But come on, the evidence is overwhelming. They don't support a diversity of views and opinions. I mean, it's becoming so pervasive in some disciplines on university campuses that a group of over 5,000 professors, administrators, staff, and students formed what's called the Heterodox Academy in 2015 with the mission, in quotes, support open inquiry, viewpoint diversity, and constructive disagreement in research and education. Well, I do wish them luck, but they didn't form that because there wasn't a problem. This week, BlackRock's reporter chronicles the story of University of Ottawa professor Amir Adiran, who in his testimony before the Commons Health Committee criticized Canada's health agency and Prime Minister Trudeau for the COVID response, only to find out later that his chances of receiving research grants from the agency were about zero. This is a regular complaint we hear by many academics who question the prevailing government narrative on prominent issues like climate change or COVID. And by the way, it's not like criticism of the public health agency wasn't warranted, for goodness sakes. A compelling argument can be made that no government agency made more missteps during the pandemic. I mean, they failed to do their specific job. This is what they were supposed to do, prepare a pandemic response plan. They didn't. How about this? 6 months or so before the pandemic, they destroyed 8.9 million pieces of protective equipment, including masks, gloves, and medical gowns. And as the Auditor General, Karen Hogan, reported, the agency repeatedly failed to respond to problems that have been identified for years. But the point is, Professor Adiran's experience has been repeated numerous times when it comes to challenging the government narrative. As well-known climate scientist Judith Curry states, in quotes, research and other professional activities are professionally rewarded only if they're channeled in certain directions approved by a politicized academic establishment. Come on, this past week, Johns Hopkins professor and surgeon, member of the National Academy of Medicine, Dr. Marty Makary, stated in quotes, there is a modern day McCarthyism in science whereby researchers who question certain sacred cows assumptions using the scientific method are bullied by their universities and worry about their future National Institute of Health funding. I invite you to think about that. Not even a global pandemic has reversed the trend of, in quotes, approved lines of inquiry. In fact, it's worse. And is there a more anti-science attitude than don't question the status quo narrative? Yet we have no shortage of people declaring follow the science without a whiff of concern over the full frontal assault that's been taking place. As Leighton Woodhouse observes, in quotes, I believe in science has come to mean I do not question expert authority, which is antithetical to the scientific spirit as you can get. The more gravely the line is in tone, the more Orwellian it becomes, end of quote. Now, the good news is that the mainstream media has seen an exodus of very well-known writers like Barry Weiss, Glenn Greenwald, Andrew Sullivan. They left their jobs because of what Ms. Weiss calls an orthodoxy. Whereas Alberta talk show host Danielle Smith stated in resigning earlier this year, in quotes, over the last few years, too many topics have become unchallengeable. Let me give you another example of how fast the attitudes toward free speech are changing. Think about this. It was just in 2015, the aftermath of the murders at the Paris magazine, Charlie Hebdo. You had politicians, members of the mainstream media, and the vast majority of the public making a major show of support for free speech. All over the internet, there were messages, pictures of people holding signs that read, "I am Charlie Hebdo. We are Charlie Hebdo." I mean, come on, how many times over the years have you heard commentators repeat the cliche, "I may not agree with what you have to say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it." Well, we're only 6 years later. It would be absurd to suggest that's the prevailing attitude now. Instead, as Barry Weiss observes, and thousands of others, by the way, have experienced, there's a prevailing orthodoxy that you pay a price for challenging. Yet not many people seem concerned, which is why I'm bringing it up today. No questions allowed? Punishment for challenging the prevailing government or social narrative? Well, come on, that's profoundly anti-progress. It used to be one of the fundamental distinctions between a democracy and a totalitarian regime, but increasingly, that distinction's being blurred. You know, at first I thought maybe increasing censorship is one of the things that you get concerned, but only once it impacts you directly. Then I realized it already has for most of us. Come on. I think we can think of opinions that we have on subjects that we wouldn't dare bring up at work or in social situations. I mean, we've already been censored. And do you think it's only Barry Weiss or Danielle Smith or others like Glenn Greenwald in the mainstream media who've experienced it, or Judith Curry, Roger Pilkey in climate science, or Dr. Marty Makary or Canadian Dr. Kavinder Kaur who've experienced the efforts to silence debate? Well, of course not. But they're the courageous ones who speak out, an example to every one of us who is worried about the assault on free speech. Well, I hope you join them before it's too late. As I said, we got a lot planned for you today on the show, but I'll give you one more reminder. You know, last week we did the, if you sign up for the World Outlook Conference, you could get a 1 ounce silver maple leaf thanks to Border Gold. Well, that happened pretty darn quickly. So we phoned up Border Gold and said, can you help us get some more? And they sure did, but it's really only another 100. And the reason is we can't guarantee delivery before Christmas if you don't get your orders in the next couple of days. So that's incentive enough to go to mikesmoneytalks.ca, sign on for the World Outlook Conference. If you're one of the first 100 to do it from this moment on, hey, you could win a 1 ounce. You will win. It's not a win. You'll get a 1 ounce maple leaf silver coin. I'll take a break. I'll come back. So much more planned for you. Obviously, a lot of focus on the Omicron variation or mutation and the impact when you hear different lockdowns here or you hear flight restrictions. But I think still arguably the biggest story in finance this week had to be the Federal Reserve doing an about face on their mantra that, don't worry, all the inflation numbers we're getting are only short term. As Jerome Powell, head of the Fed, sort of threw in the towel and says, you know, maybe it's going to be higher and longer than we thought. I want to bring in Mike Levy to talk about this. Mike, the word transitory became one of the top words in the financial lexicon, but Jerome Powell sort of tossed it out this week.
He did. He's retired. Transitory has been retired officially, maybe not to be heard from again in our financial lifetime, because take a look at what inflation is doing in Canada in October, up 4.7%. In the U.S., it's up 6.2%. And those are numbers that are going to force the Federal Reserve, the Bank of Canada, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank to start raising interest rates. And they're going to have to do it sooner than later. We've got the U.S. looking at doing it now, the beginning of next year. It was going to be the end of 2022 or 2023. The Bank of Canada came in before the U.S. Federal Reserve, warning in every which way interest rates are going up probably at the end of the first quarter of 2022.
Yeah, I mean, the significance, very straightforward. You know, if prices are rising at 4, 5, 6, 7%, and you're receiving under 1% in, say, a five-year Government of Canada bond and a U.S. Treasury, well, you're losing money. You're guaranteed by the time that matures, you'll have taken in, say, 0.75%, 1%, yet your prices that you're buying stuff with go up 5 or 6 or even higher. So that's been the problem. That's why they've been playing this sort of transitory word game with us. But as I say, significant that they threw in the towel. And what I think it also does, Mike, I mean, keep in mind, our listeners, I hope, are familiar with the fact that our central banks have been monster buyers of Government of Canada bonds, U.S. treasuries, et cetera. That's why we've got record low rates. That's this whole deal about tapering. They're going to pull back, as the Bank of Canada has already done, pull back in the amount of government bonds that they're buying. So the timetable, as you said, for that looks like it's getting moved up.
It is, and Powell rocked the markets this week. It's not only the Omicron virus and what impact that's going to have, but also the fact that he has absolutely done an about face, as we said, on when inflation's going up. And what they've done, Mike, is they have taken price stability and given that precedent over full employment. It was always both of them. Full employment is absolutely out of the conversation now. It's price stability, and they are going to go ahead and they are going to raise those interest rates, no doubt about it. I think Mike, President Biden might want to do a recall of his appointment of Jerome Powell, because he's certainly not getting what he banked on when he made that appointment.
Well, I'm going to be chatting with Victor Adair and Kevin Muir about this, but I'm not so sure it's a guarantee that rates go up significantly. Bump up, yes. And I'll tell you why. Is because, let's face it, we're a world awash with debt. Our governments have record amounts of debt. Individuals also, especially in the mortgage side of things. So this is the rock and a hard place we've been chatting about for months, is what will they do when inflation would normally force rates much higher? And yet, if they do go much higher, you're creating a whole bunch of other problems for individuals, for corporations, and for government itself.
And Mike, this week we had the Omicron variant come into our lexicon, using that word again, and that has punched the markets. And now we have the interest rates going up in both Canada and the U.S. It's as assured as anything can be. And the markets reacted quite violently to that. I think also looking for an excuse for a correction, because we've been going up so significantly over this last year. But boy, I'll tell you, those two items back to back in the same week were certainly a catalyst for the markets reacting the way they did.
With your context, as you say, you're coming off of record highs, so there's a lot of profit to be taken if people want to do that, want to get spooked. We'll be chronicling, and of course, as I say, Kevin Muir coming up. I've got Victor Adair coming up. We'll talk more about that. Mike, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, Mike.
Time now for the quote of the week. This comes from Jerry DeMarco. He's Canada's Commissioner for the Environment and Sustainable Development. Well, I'd say it was a wake-up call, but that would require me to completely ignore the fact that wake-up calls are really not Canadian strong suits, but that won't stop me. This week's quote chronicles the hollowness, the shallowness, the ineffective promises on climate change and other environmental issues. Well, maybe not a surprise when the principal characteristic of Canada's environmental crusade is virtue signaling and political grandstanding, which, by the way, is widely applauded in the media and I think by the majority of the public. But this is directly from the commissioner's report to Parliament, in quotes. Canada was once a leader in the fight against climate change. However, after a series of missed opportunities, it's become the worst performer of all 7 G7 nations since the landmark Paris Agreement on climate change was adopted in 2015. We can't continue to go from failure to failure. We need action and results, not just more targets and plans. All too often, Canada's environmental commitments are not met with the actions needed, end of quote. Gee, I wonder if he got the same kind of hate mail I do when I say stuff like that. The one sure bet is that no one, no politician, certainly none of the cheerleaders in the media are going to be accountable. But allow me a personal shout out here. That's to the people, especially the nasty ones, who take exception anytime I've pointed out there's no realistic, practical plan when it comes to climate change, especially the transition to renewable energy and electric vehicles. And I'm going to finish with one example. As BlackRock's reporter notes, this week, the Department of Industry put out a report that concluded that the federal cabinet's plan to convert at least 80% of all government-issued vehicles to zero emission by 2030 is, in quotes, not realistic at this time for the majority of their department's fleet. You know, and their department only has 254 vehicles in total. We've got 89 pickup trucks in that total, 55 vans, 30 SUVs. Obviously not many. But the department cites the lack of public charging stations, repair shops, the fact that automotive technology is not readily available for all the operational requirements it has. These are all the significant obstacles, but not just for that department. Go across the country, across society. But you know what? I'm not sure who cares. Clearly not a majority of Canadians who place a bigger emphasis on saying the right things than taking the right action. You know, I just love when I look at the sort of the evolution of technology, and I love it when it works out as an investment too, by the way, but it's for business, for consumers, and investors. And this is one of those subjects. I've got Martin van den Bemd on the line with me. He's the general manager for North America for AdCore. And Martin, let me just start with asking you, tell us a little bit about AdCore.
Absolutely, Mike. So AdCore is a company for in advertising technology. We help our clients with the use of our technology to manage the advertising campaigns at scale. And this is digital advertising. So this is bringing their ads on Google, their ads on Facebook, on Microsoft. And we have the technology to do it in a very scalable, fast, and automated fashion. Then there's another part of the business, which we recently launched called Amphi on amphi.com. And this is a live online recreational learning platform. So this is where people can learn guitar lessons, where they can learn languages, how to bake a cake, all types of different classes that are very much in the recreational space.
Well, I'll give you an example why it catches my eye. I'm familiar, obviously, with AdCore, but also you look at something that gets a lot of publicity, like Salesforce or Shopify, you know, examples of this subscription-based, license-based business models. And you look at their performance, you say, I wouldn't mind more of that.
I couldn't agree more. There's a lot of potential for these subscription-based models. And to your point, Salesforce, Shopify, but also HubSpot had a tremendous growth the last couple of years. So if you look at Salesforce, for instance, 62% growth in the last 2 years. Shopify, even 300% growth. And HubSpot is there to top that with 433% growth in the last 2 years. So it's an amazing opportunity. And what's typically for SaaS businesses, subscription-based models, is that they charge a monthly rate. And therefore, it's very predictable. It's recurring and therefore sticky revenue. So a lot of investors like that because you can calculate and you can predict future earnings while companies grow very fast, especially in these times of digital transformation.
Let's come back and talk exactly how, as you say, the acronym is SaaS, S-A-A-S, subscription-based, license-based business models. Can you walk us through, like, how does that work for Shopify? You know, they've been a huge beneficiary, but what's the nature of taking advantage and leveraging the SaaS business model?
Absolutely, Mike. So SaaS stands for Software as a Service. How it typically works is that users get access typically through an internet browser, so it's all in the cloud. They start sometimes for a very cheap or low fee, and then start using the technology, start using this software and this service in the cloud. Typically, when people are getting the first results, getting to use in the platform, they want more functionality, more activity. And that's where typically the companies like that start charging more. And that's why it's so interesting. There's a lot of stickiness to it. There is the opportunity for companies like Salesforce, but also Shopify or HubSpot to charge more for their services, more activity, and as the client or the customer is more successful on the platform itself, the price increase in the same cadence, as, if you will.
So give us an example. For example, if I so I can subscribe online to a service. And you know what reminds me is that Abcor, I'm smiling because you wouldn't look at me and think this is it, but Abcor does, for example, cooking, you know, that you make that available, cooking classes. So people subscribe. And of course, then there's a monthly revenue coming out of that.
Absolutely. So we launched this marketplace for live recreational learning. How it works is people sign up for the platform, they book a class, for instance, a language class or a cooking class, and they can do this a one-time class. But what we also encourage them to do is to buy a bundle and basically keep coming back, which is very popular for our classes like languages, where you need to keep practicing, keep interacting with your teachers. Same for jazz classes or other things where, let's say, you want to play, learn to play the guitar. That's also things that we are offering the bundles for. And that's recurring revenue where we, again, can predict and build a relationship with this client, this user, and get more revenue per user over time.
I think, you know, and also just I'm going all over because this is a big subject, but it's so much of the future. And as we alluded to those companies, for example, who've leveraged it. So it's been great for investors. And we're talking, you know, what I just asked is like for consumers. And then there's obviously businesses like Shopify who have benefited greatly. That's why I think it's such an important topic to get more information on, which, by the way, we're doing a webinar on Tuesday morning. It's going to be available at 9 a.m. I'll give you more details, but it's from the investor side, because obviously when you get, who wouldn't have wanted to own HubSpot, you know, in 2 years up 400%+, or Shopify or Salesforce, and a lot of their success comes back to this. This is why it's worth understanding it. But as I say, also as a business, you want to understand this. I mean, the advantage for a business, I would assume, is you get this recurring revenue stream.
Absolutely. And it's one thing I like to add there as well. What you typically see is the massive scalability of these companies. And also what we do for AdCore, where we basically help companies with the digital advertising spend. They get a license that can be as cheap as $40 per month. As they grow, as they bring in more revenue, that license scales with them. They get more features and capabilities. And what I also like about the scalability, and definitely for investors to look at, is while you grow the revenue, even double the revenue, that doesn't necessarily mean that the cost is doubling or tripling as well. So the resources needed to double the revenue for companies in the SaaS industry or the subscription-based industry is very, very low compared to the growth that you can generate together. So it's a really amazing industry. A lot of growth is there possible. And during the webinar, we are more than happy to tell investors what the opportunity is in this specific vertical.
That's why it's such an interesting subject, because as I say, as consumers, as a business owner, as an investor, all of it impacted, because, I mean, we're talking about the evolution of communication with customers, as you know, one way of putting it, sort of how much that's changed to leverage the sort of technology of today. Companies like AdCore are already doing it, of course, and these other companies we've just been alluding to have certainly leveraged it a great deal. But I mean, you just can't ignore this kind of thing.
Absolutely. It's big. It's continued to grow across many companies. So I definitely recommend investors to look out. Companies that are in the SaaS industry are selling licenses, subscriptions. Look at the growth rates, both on the revenue side, but also on the market cap appreciation over time. A lot of the opportunity there. And again, very happy to see a lot of people in the webinar, so we can tell more about them and about this very interesting topic.
And let me just remind people, the webinar is Tuesday. It's available at 9 a.m. Tuesday, but you could watch it after that also. Just go to mikesmoneytalks.ca, mikesmoneytalks.ca. It's for our audience. But as I say, an area that is so fascinating. We know the companies, when you name it, something like Shopify, you know who's been leveraging it. But as I say, there's so many aspects for investors, obviously, when you see those kind of results, but it's also for individual businesses. And it's interesting for individuals, consumers, to realize how this is expanding. And AdCore, as I say, one of those businesses that fully versed in it, but also taking advantage and helping other companies take advantage. Martin, thanks so much for finding time. It's a fascinating subject.
It was my pleasure, Mike. Thanks for so much for having me today.
I'll also, by the way, say to go adcore.com, www.adcore.com. You can go there. Martin van de Bem is the general manager for North America. I've been looking forward to get a chance to talk with Kevin Muir, the macro tourist. Love his work. Someone with analytical chops and also a great way of presenting it, the macro tourist, which you can find at the macro tourist at substack.com. That's one of the places, the macro tourist at substack.com. You can also follow Kevin on Twitter. Kevin, first of all, got to say this. I appreciate so much you finding time for us. And I guess I've arranged for a heck of a lot of things to talk about the way this environment's going. So I'm just going to throw a few out. And I want to start with the reaction to the Omicron virus story that really hit the markets a week ago Friday.
Yeah, so it's great to be with you today. The Omicron virus is more than likely, I believe, just an excuse for a market that was positioned incorrectly. And one of the reasons I believe that is because if you look at the South African stock market, you'll see that it actually declined and led the way in the initial moments when this was announced. But subsequent to that, over the last 3 or 4 days, it's actually rallied and it's back near the highs. And meanwhile, the U.S. stock market just seems to be going lower. People love to come up with excuses why something is happening, but a lot of times it's just because the kind of market participants have gotten over their skis too much, and there's too many longs, and they're, you know, ringing the register and taking profits, and any excuse is an excuse to sell. And so we're blaming the Omicron virus, and it's probably not as much what's driving the actual action as many people believe. The other thing that is probably negative, and just as much, you know, if you wanted to blame something on this recent sell-off, is the fact that Powell has definitely made a shift. We thought that Powell was erring a little bit on the hawkish side, and he sent us some conflicting messages last week. But then during the Senate Banking Committee testimony, he definitely said they're about to, get to a point where they are going to taper. And one of my subscribers coined the term, it's the green light for tough love. And the Fed that used to be a tailwind has all of a sudden become a stiff headwind for us.
And, you know, obviously the markets have been so focused on Federal Reserve policy. I mean, you go back, the cliches like don't fight the Fed, and boy, there's never been easier monetary policy, with the pandemic. And then you get the fiscal spending on top of that, et cetera. And that's why he's been signaling so much about, hey, it is going to come. But again, I'm thinking for long-term investors in the stock market, I should have clarified, in the stock market, how significant is it? I mean, are you looking for, you know, we hear a variety of estimates. You could get 2 rate increases next year, maybe 8 is the high I've seen over the next 2 years. That may have more significance, but really a quarter point, a half point even, does really make a difference in the stock side of things?
So I couldn't agree with you more. If we step back and think about what Powell has just signified, he isn't even telling you that he's going to raise rates. He's merely saying the rate upon which we are expanding the balance sheet is going to slow. It's not that they're going to stop expanding the balance sheet. They're just going to slow the rate upon which they expand it. We are miles away from an actual contraction in the balance sheet. We're probably still another 6 months away from the first hike. And even then, once we get the hike, like you highlighted, the reality is that rates are zero. And inflation is running 3 at the minimum, maybe 6, depending on whether this is transitory or, you know, the one-off effects. Monetary policy is still extremely easy. And then the final piece of the puzzle is when you go look, even though the initial reaction to a Fed hike is often a knee-jerk kind of sell, it often takes many of those hikes before the stock market and the economy rolls over. The problem is that we've been so juiced up by, let's say, the hype around all of this monetary policy that investors, just as I said, they got too far ahead of themselves. And we especially saw them get too far ahead of themselves in very speculative names. And so what we're experiencing right now is a lot of those speculative names, the so-called meme stocks and the ARK, which is the Cathie Wood's hedge fund that had all these dream type, names in there. All those things are coming unglued, and they rightfully should. These stocks, the valuations on these things were extreme. They were ridiculous. It was more a function of the stock. I would say it was more the stock market not functioning correctly this summer when these things were priced at these just ridiculous values. And now what we're experiencing is the stock market starting to react and to price things, these things properly. So if I was a long-term investor and thinking about this, panic or problems that we have right now, this is a great opportunity to be buying real economy stocks. Because when I look out a year, I think this economy is going to be doing quite well. I think we're going to see a situation where these meme stocks that with these valuations that aren't deserved get brought back to earth. They get cut in half, maybe even 75%. But stocks with, actual real businesses are bid and they go up. For example, I look at the Canadian insurers. I think they're a great buy here. We're getting interest rates that are going to be headed higher, and these stocks are still cheap. And for the investor that is more than just a day trader and trying to flip around the most speculative, Bitcoin or GameStop, this is just a lot of noise around not that big a deal, and you should be using it to your advantage by buying quality names.
Lots of things I want to come back on that. The first is just to make sure everyone's sort of generally up to speed. I'm going to oversimplify, but let's keep in mind when the pandemic hit, who the heck wanted to buy bonds? Nobody. I mean, the whole thing was coming to a halt. So the central banks stepped in and they were the ones buying government bonds at rates that no individual would accept, like 1% for 5 years in that level of uncertainty. And that's what Chairman Powell's talking about. As Kevin, a wonderful point he's making. He's not even saying I'm stopping that. He's saying right. I'm going to reduce that. So there's no big shake. And then the other point you're making on that is just people should be clear, because I hear actually some analysts is making a little bit of a mistake. Just stopping that doesn't guarantee higher interest rates. It's not that the Fed's going to raise rates. And I think that's just a point in distinction, is that he's just slowing the rate of which the government, the central banks are going to support government. We've already done that in Canada. We went from $5 billion a week buying government bonds from the central bank to $1 billion, I think it is now. So that's slowed down. They haven't slowed down near as much in the States. But I want to come then back to the stock market here. It's fascinating, and maybe elaborate a little bit more for us, because what you're describing is it's not a monolithic stock market. You could look inside the market and find stocks that are off 25% while the overall index is off 5, as an example. Some things are already paying a price, and it's up to the individual to revisit their own portfolio.
Right. And to that end, I recently wrote about the fact that even though the stock market is 5% from the all-time highs, maybe 6% when we're talking about the S&P 500, we're in a situation where we have, let's say, if we look at the universe of stocks, we have a huge amount that are down 25%. I think if I remember the stats right, there's 486 stocks that trade at $2 or above that are off more than 25% in the last 30 days. So if we take those, that amount, and then we look at the last time the stock market was down this much, and then that was 2018 at the same time of year, which was December, the stock market, the S&P, was down 20% on its own, and there was less stocks that were down 25%. There was something like 386 stocks. So what we've had is the stock market hang in there pretty well, but yet the average stock is getting absolutely crushed. And one of the things that is occurring, and you alluded to this when you said that the stock market, when we talk about it, we have to realize that there's different elements to it. There's different portions of it. One of the problems is that if you look at the U.S. stock market and you look at the top six names, most of them are tech. I believe they're all tech. And they account for a huge portion of the index. So even now, when we have this, all these wobbling, we have the Apple, which is the world's largest stock, rallying into this. And so what I think is happening is that many professional investors are actually just rushing into the winners of last year, of this year, and just going into the quote unquote safe stocks. And those safe stocks are these six names that I think are vastly, vastly overpriced. And if there's some, if there's a danger in the stock market, I would say it's those six stocks that they're too high. I think that we have a situation where they're getting squeezed into year end. And when I think of, when I look out to 2022 and I try to explain what be a surprise that would catch the market off guard, I would say it's those six stocks are down by a third or something big. And unfortunately, that's going to make the stock market probably go sideways. But yet, if you look, if that money comes out of those six stocks and goes into banks and goes into energy and all these other things, the market cap will, you know, the indexes might go sideways, but those other stocks will go up a lot more because they're so much smaller than those six stocks in terms of market capitalizations. So in a lot of ways, this is a great opportunity, and there's a lot of things and kind of opportunities for the retail investor out there to go up in value of their portfolio and no longer chase those winning stocks that are just so stupidly priced.
And those stocks made you feel so FOMO-ish, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's hard, especially myself, obviously, and it's what you do for a living, but you know, I'm watching the market. It feels like momentarily. And you go, goodness gracious, I could have owned Tesla at X and now it's $9,000, you know, yeah. And I don't own any Tesla, but the valuations make no sense to me, you know, that kind of thing. And I think there was a lot of that in the market, feeling like you're chasing. As you say, and that's such a great point, you know, we know who the all-stars are. We know what the names are. You don't even have to be, you know, if I walked into somebody off the street who doesn't follow this stuff, I think they know that Apple and Amazon done pretty well, you know.
Right. But they might not understand what a large portion of the S&P 500 it is.
Definitely.
And how big those stocks have become and how much risk there is in it. And it reminds me of the time in the late 90s when Bell and Nortel, and don't forget, Bell owned a whole bunch of Nortel, accounted for something like 40% of the TSX 300 index. It was monstrous, and you couldn't afford to not have it if you were an active manager. And the reality is, as it went higher, the pain of not being fully invested and not having a market weighted in essence, kind of made you short. And so those investors had to chase it, and it was a feeling of that FOMO that you explained, and it just took it to a crazy, crazy level. But if you were a retail investor that didn't have to worry about your relative performance over the next 1 month, 3 months, or next year, you could afford to say, this makes absolutely no sense. I don't know when it's going to end, but I know it's going to end. And I feel like that's the similar situation when you look at the Teslas and the Facebooks and all these stocks and their valuations. You say, listen, I can afford to underperform because I'm not getting marked to market. I'm not having my assets under management get pulled away because I underperformed. And that inherent is a huge advantage for retail investors. But the trouble is, to do that, you have to make sure that you don't succumb to those same emotional traps that the professional does.
Let's come back to also then the areas of the market you're more comfortable with that aren't subject to that, you know, aren't the high flyers, but stuff that, as you say, real economy things that, you know, you look out and people can be more patient with. And they're not high flyers, but they're solid in terms of potential return.
Yeah. So I love the insurance companies. They're just, don't forget, insurance companies, lower rates hurts them a lot. And they've suffered because we've had a situation where we've had lower rates for years and years and years, in fact, decades. And there's been very little opportunity for them to grow. There was all sorts of worries. I think that we're going to look back and those are just the kind of quality companies that you should be picking away at. They're not exciting. They're not going to make you rich, but they're going to sit there. They're going to pay you a good yield. As interest rates go higher, they should do better. Other things like energy. I love energy. I think that energy stocks, if you look at the energy as a portion of the index, meaning like how much do the energy stocks comprise of the index? I can't remember the figures, but at some point, I think it was 20% of the S&P 500. It's under 2% now. Energy stocks are tiny. They've been left for dead. There's lots to unpack there. But the crux of the argument from a bull thesis is that we have a situation where professional investors have been hamstrung. They're not allowed to buy it anymore. They've been selling it for years and years and years. We've had a situation where both governments and professional investors have tried to starve the whole industry of capital to make it so that we do this switch to green energy. And you can be all for green energy, but the reality is that in the meantime, we still need to use fossil fuels. And in fact, you could argue we need more fossil fuels, because to make that transition to green energy, we need to spend more energy building those things. So we have a situation where the energy that was needed over the next years or maybe even a decade is much higher than the market expects. And we're going to see those energy companies that are so cheap continue to trade better. So I think they're a great investment. And you know, if you feel bad about buying the fossil fuels, you pair them with some green energy stocks as well. Buy those, because there's no doubt that from an infrastructure and spending point of view, we're going to be doing a lot more of that going forward. The other thing to think about is that if you look at the electrification of the globe, meaning that if we go more and more to electric cars and all these things that we're trying to do and shift away from fossil fuels, we need to do a lot. We need a lot of copper. We need tons and tons of copper, and there isn't enough of it. And there's another example of an industry that you can own. Buy some copper stocks. They're although they're up, they're not up considering how much we're going to need.
And you just, as I say, we jumped into that because copper, and I'm looking, it's one of the themes on our show, and I'm proud of it, because we said we did the Outlook conference in February 2020, said it was the coming bull market in commodities, and they had not started particularly at that point, but it was copper, it's nickel, it's lithium. So, do you think that whole group, as we move the transition to renewable energy, is sort of in play?
Yeah, this isn't something that's going away in 6 months. This is something that we're going to need a lot more of for a long, long time. And if you look at how much copper we need, we're not producing enough. We're going to need to make more of it. And to me, it's just you got to own some copper, because it's going to be the new fossil fuel over the longer term. So buy it and forget about it. Try not to look at the quote too much.
And let me come just move over a little bit on that and get a quick comment on precious metals, on, you know, with the degree to which money was created, is being created in the system, or, you know, the Biden government, for example, is at what, $6 trillion now spending, and they've got more coming, et cetera. Traditionally, people would say, well, that should have resulted in a more significant move in gold. What do you make of that?
Yes, it's been kind of one of those disappointments for me. I would say that the Bitcoin has really been a formidable competitor to gold, and that it has been a disappointment. I'm a little worried about it over the short run, because gold traditionally moves with what's known as real rates, and real rates are the rates minus inflation. Those were, in essence, very negative at the point when the Fed was no longer raising rates. The trouble is that we've had a situation where the market has assumed the Fed will raise rates. So we have real rates going up in terms of becoming less negative. And that is weighed on gold. I still, though, believe in the long run that it's a good investment. I believe that there's always room for it. And one of the things that I'm most excited about with gold is that eventually I believe it will be the central banks that come for it and will be the real buyers of gold.
Yeah,
So we've seen them come back now, but during COVID they went away. And you saw a situation where Russia and Poland and the countries that were buying gold previously, their central banks put it on hold as they tried to get through the COVID. And I believe that that was part of the reason that gold sagged, and they're back now. And then the other thing to think about is, if I'm putting on my trader's hat, there's a lot of tax loss selling to be done right now. Tax loss meaning that, if you're sitting there and you're long Google or long Amazon or Tesla, and you have all these gains and you want to sell them, you're going to want to pay tax. Well, at the same time, you can harvest something. You can sell one of your losers. So if you go through and look at what's been the losers, and especially in Canada, junior gold stocks have been one of the most disappointing areas. There's lots of retail that's in the names. I suspect that right now we're taping this, in the first week of December. I suspect that we're going to see that tax loss selling, let's just say accelerate, but very quickly come to a conclusion. And it's tough to say whether it's going to be next week or in the final moments of December. But from a longer term perspective, I think you're going to look at this period of December and say there was a chance to buy a lot of these gold miners on the cheap. And for me, I'm going to use December 11th as my date that I'm going to start really picking away at the junior gold miners. I just happened upon a study that had been done over the last 30 years, and I can't remember the exact details, but it was something like from, December 11th to January 1st, if you looked at the Fidelity Gold Mining Index, I can't remember the exact details, but it was something like 26 of the last 30 years it's been up. And trading isn't precise. I'm just looking for ideas. And to me, the idea of picking up gold miners down here in the midst of all this sell-off as a tax loss potential candidate is very attractive. The other thing from a tax loss perspective that's very attractive is cannabis stocks. Cannabis stocks are also something that retail has just gotten crushed on. There's no doubt that there's a lot of names that are way, way off. And, we're seeing some situation where in the U.S., there's increasingly rumbles about that it's going to get legalized. It seems to be one of the few things that both parties can agree on. And so that's another one that might be attractive for picking away at in this December time period.
Let's finish with just one quick statement, and that is you look forward, you look out at 2022. What do you think what would you tell your nephew, say, whatever you do, don't make this mistake?
Well, that's a great question. I would say that when this bubble in GMC, AMC, Bitcoin, Tesla, the real speculative bubble comes and it breaks. And I do believe there is a decent chance that what we're experiencing is the breaking of this bubble. It will be very tempting to say, oh my goodness, look at this. It's on sale. It's now down 25%. And just like Nortel, I very distinctly remember that there was a situation where it ran up to 140 and then all of a sudden it's 100 and everyone says it's on sale. It's great. It's terrific. And over the coming years, it was just a vicious bear market that crushed a lot of people. And I would be really, really, really scared that people are going to look at this and just make the same mistake that when what happened with Nortel when it comes to these other speculative names.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely great advice. And I just want to remind people, you can go to the macrotourist.com, subscribe for Kevin's letter. Comes out 2-3 times a week, the macrotourist.com. But the other thing, and regular listeners will know Patrick Zarezna from our show here, Patrick and Kevin do a podcast called The Market Huddle. The Market Huddle, just go to markethuddle.com. That's simple.
You're too kind to mention it. Yes, we like to have some fun. We even drink some beers while we do it. Very, very Canadian of us.
There you go. Kevin, thanks so much for finding time. This has been great.
Thank you for having me on. It's always great to chat with you guys.
Hey, before I get to the shocking stat of the week, I thought I'd better acknowledge why this kind of thing drives me crazy. In brief, I've been outraged by the lack of pandemic support for Canadians with intellectual disabilities, despite the fact that other than age as a factor, having an intellectual disability is the strongest independent risk factor when it comes to dying from COVID. And by the way, I have yet to talk about the outrageous actions of some of our politicians because there's a fear that there may be reprisals, as I've seen in so many other instances. So I tell you this, if this doesn't change, I promise I will give you the details. But for now, the lack of funds for our most vulnerable citizens is why I'm so outraged when I hear how much money was wasted in the CERB program. Enough to make an incredible difference in helping people with intellectual disabilities or addiction problems, domestic abuse, or homelessness. programs that in many instances go begging for adequate funds. And please be clear, I understand this is just my issue. I'm making no assumptions that it's yours, but it is our tax dollars. It is part of the debt we're passing on to our children. So to the shocking stat, data shows that 8.9 million Canadians claimed CERB checks. The actual number of new unemployed, though, who lost work as a result of the pandemic peaked at about 1.5 million in May 2020, according to Stats Canada's labor force surveys. Did you hear that, though? 8.9 collected CERB, but only 1.5 had lost their job due to the pandemic. Claims for $2,000 Canada Emergency Response Benefit checks were six times the number of COVID-related jobless. The federal government budgeted the program at $24 billion. You know, the actual payments, though, were about $82 billion. And the cost overruns have never been explained. I hope you're shocked by that. Access to information records showed that the CERB program intended to save jobless taxpayers from eviction or foreclosure, but instead paid out $636 million, for example, in checks to high school students. Payouts included 41,000 claims by grade 9 students. Technically, I mean, well, I don't even have to go into that. 41,000 grade 9 students. Records also disclose suspiciously high rates of payouts in select communities. More than half of the adult residents in Old Crow, Yukon, received CERB checks. The district's unemployment rate, well, about 12%. This is the kind of stuff, by the way, I've got to give a thank you to BlackRock's reporter who gives you the details of some of the records that we don't see generally in the media. It's another reason to listen to Money Talks. But I was in favor, by the way, of supporting individuals and businesses. In fact, I was in favor of that, talking about it before the first restriction was announced. But you know what? Even for me, this was not a blank check. There's a couple of things that were jumping out at me in the real estate market this week. So I wanted to get Ozzy Jurek back in here, and you can find Ozzy at ozbuzz.ca. Ozzy, let's start with, you know, again, the persistence of the real estate increase across Canada. We had a REMAX survey this week saying that 95% of Canadian markets are what we call seller's markets. But you look in the States, it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. The Schiller Index came out and said that in September, the average price increase was 19.5%. In August, it was 19.8%, so as close as possible to 20%. Now, that's 20% on the price of the property. And what people don't often realize is the enormous amount of leverage the average buyer has when he buys a house.
Yeah, but what's interesting about that, I mean, you're so right, but we get the REMAX survey saying they're looking for about a 9% average increase across the country in Canada. But at the same time, we've had Canada Housing and Mortgage Corporation. We've had the Bank of Canada. We've had several financial institutions worried about the real estate market because there is so much leverage, because we've borrowed so much money. I think the last time I saw, we got about $1.8 trillion in mortgage debt in this country. And they're worried that a bump up in interest rates, as we discussed with Mike Levy, discussed with Kevin Muir, really could spell some trouble. So it's kind of interesting. But I mean, at the same time, as you point out, that's a heck of a way to make a lot of money, which encourages more people.
Well, the millennials are out there, Mike. When I talk to anybody of my grandkids and they're in the market and they're playing and they're saying, well, I'm getting a 10-4 or a 5-4. I said, what the hell is a 5-4 or a 5X? Well, if I put down 10,000, the platform will grant me 50,000. Yeah, but it goes the other way. You could lose all that. Well, that's going up, isn't it? So we have this kind of an attitude. And in real estate, it is so misleading. People saying the prices are up 5% and you think, well, that's really okay. But if I have a $1 million house and I put down $100,000 and prices up 5%, I made a 50% increase in my money. And you look at in Surrey, the average homeowner just sat back for 2 years, didn't do anything, paid $1 million for a house. Now it's worth $1.7 million. And if you put down 10%, $100,000, it's now worth a $700,000 profit. That's a 7X or a 7-4. And that has driven more people into the market.
But and this is where individuals have to look at their own circumstances to see what debt levels are affordable, because, you know, I mean, at some point you're going to get a correction in these markets. And you have these major institutions warning about that. So you've got to make sure you can handle your payments, that you could sit back for a year or two, not have that price appreciation impact your holdings. It's just an interesting thing. I mean, this is a world that's built on debt. And when you're on the right side of it, my goodness, that can be profitable. You could have done it in stocks. Maybe you borrowed money for Bitcoin. Who knows? Or you can get on the wrong side, because leverage is also the root of all the major problems that could come in the system, also for individuals. So it's a fascinating time. And one of the reasons we talk interest rates all the time here. But let me come back to something here. Ozzie, what do you think is driving? I mean, I know this is a Barbara Walters. I'll give you 10 seconds to tell me what's driving the market.
Well, it's clear. First of all, it's a worldwide phenomena. It is inflation. It's worldwide printing. We talked about 2 weeks ago, the UBS bubble index saw Frankfurt as the leading, most bubbliest city in the world. Frankfurt, quiet state, Germany, having price increases. And whether you go to Hungary or whether you go to New York or Toronto, we're all seeing big prices. So inflation is part of it. But secondly, people are really on the move in the United States. They're leaving California in droves. They hate these mayors who come up with idiotic things. They're seeing their stores robbed by mobs. They're seeing the police discharged. And so, hey, I'm going to move to Austin, or I'm going to move to Texas, or, you know, Phoenix, or some of those areas. And that's why the prices might be up 20% across the board in the U.S., but in Phoenix, they're up 33% in a year.
Well, again, taxes and regulation playing a big part. I mean, it's not my opinion. I'm looking at what Elon Musk said, why Tesla's moving plants into Texas, as an example, and so many other major companies. So it's a really great example where I think it was Bjorn Borg who said high taxes don't redistribute income. They redistribute taxpayers. and this is what we're seeing there. I'll give you just one quick one, because I know you look at these stats, Ozzie, from U-Haul. You know, you take one of those one-way 26-foot trucks, you know, the type you rent yourself so you can move your furniture and your belongings. Well, if you're going to go from San Francisco to Dallas, their latest numbers is it cost you just over $7,000. There's a lot of demand. But if you're going Dallas back to San Francisco, no one wants to go. So it's only $850. I mean, I can give you tons of other examples that are like that. But you're aware of them, but it's just kind of fun way of measuring. This is real, you know, that policies have an impact. And there are a lot of reasons. It's a sophisticated thing, whether it's, as you say, Ozzie, whether it's inflation, whether it's, you've got the low down payments and leverage playing a big part. But where they're moving to, taxes and regulation, and then, as you always say, you know, prices go where people go. Well, economic activity attracts people. So all I ever hear about, and this is anecdotal, I know, Ozzie, is Florida. I had two conversations this week with people who said, I had a job offer in Washington. I had a job offer in California, but I'm holding out for Florida. And it's the tax reasons, and, you know, and you're seeing a huge exodus out of New York City. So it's all of these factors are fascinating to have a look at.
Yeah, no question about it. But in addition to that, the government in its strive for affordability has now introduced mortgage down payments in the United States as low as 3.5% for a $600,000 mortgage. Now, that doesn't seem like much in Vancouver. What can you buy for $600? But in the U.S., the average price is between $400 and $500. So 3.5% down, and then the prices go up 20%. My God, it's like a casino. I mean, I want to be part of that. And so what we have is owners are not selling. They're saying, I'm not getting out of here. I'm just sitting here making money. But the biggest danger is that black swan you're talking about. Higher interest rates out of the blue, maybe not that high. We're already higher on the five-year term by about a full percent in Canada. We have gone up sort of slowly, you know, point by point. It's already happening. Eventually, there comes a point where this is not going to continue at the same pace.
Yeah, and the other side is this, is that, I mean, I know I've taken you too long here, but you also see this explosion, not just in major cities. You've seen this exodus into smaller towns, and there are, again, a lot of reasons, but one of them may be because it is affordability. You throw in that 3.5% down payment, hey, we can all be homeowners when the average price is like $350,000 instead of $2 million. And that would be the same phenomenon in Canada, as we see the REMAX survey telling us the action's going to be in smaller centers. Well, of course, affordability's got to be playing a part. At any rate, that's why people should go to ozbuzz.ca, because you keep them up to date on that kind of stuff, as we try to do on a weekly basis. So until next week, Ozzie, have a terrific week.
Thanks, Mike. And remember, Steve Jobs says, why join the Navy if you can be a pirate? And I think right now we have a lot of pirates out there playing the stock market and all these markets.
Avast, mateys, it's Aussie Jerks. Just go to ozbuzz.ca.
Let's go live to the trading desk now. I've got Victor Adair with me, which you can find. You can find Victor at victoradair.ca. Hey, Vic, so many things happened this past week. You know, I was chatting earlier with Kevin Muir, Michael Levy about, you know, Powell's talk about inflation and the shift there. We're still dealing with fallout from Omicron. There's just so much happening. But what's your big worry or big takeaway from all of this?
Well, Mike, I think it's just how choppy the markets have been since Friday of last week. And of course, Friday last week was an American semi-holiday. Usually it's a very low-key day. Nobody's around and all that sort of thing. But it was the day the stock markets dropped hard in what I'd call thin conditions. But that's really the essence of what's happened here. It seems to me we've had so much retail money come into the markets in the past year and so. And, you know, all of the major stock indices hit all-time highs here in November, and they're only down 6%. And I would say only, but that's say that the biggest decline since we've seen since the September-October period of last year. But it just feels like it's worse than that. I mean, I saw a few times where like the Dow Jones would swing up or down 500 points in like 30 minutes. So there is, it seems, some position unwinding. People that have got into trades, they want to get out. Nobody wants to be on the other side. And that has really ramped up volatility. So in a word, it's choppy, but it's nasty, it seems.
And as also as Kevin was saying earlier, and you were talking about it last week, these major stocks, these eight stocks dominate the index to such a degree that you could be owning, you know, some decent quality stocks, but they can be down a lot more than 5 or 6% at this point. And I just think, you know, people have to be aware, as you've said, it's not a monolith we're looking at out there. So many different things happening and these factors that are hitting it. What about this thing though, Vic, that we've, you know, be at record highs pretty much throughout the last year, or feels that way at least, you know, six straight days, that kind of thing wasn't unusual. In my experience is that people just look for excuses to take profits. And boy, there's no shortage of excuses. And I'm actually even noticing the psychology might be turning a little bit more negative.
Like there's different kinds of money coming into the market. We've got this tidal wave of retail money that's come in. Most of it, or at least more than half of it, has gone into passive investing, where the people will probably, you know, hang in there if we get a little dipsy doodle in the market. But the other chunk of the money has come in, you know, chasing hot plays, whether it's meme stocks or going into options, more leveraged stuff, people that are looking for action. Okay. And those folks, I think, are probably have been buying the dip here that we've seen in the last couple of weeks. But on the other side of that, we have got corporate buybacks. I shouldn't say the other side, but in harmony with that, corporate buybacks are probably at a record season here. But insider sales are really strong. And then there's the other guys that really intrigue me. And that is, if you and I were running a big pool of money, we've had a really good year, but we're active managers, not passive. We're likely inclined to take a little money off the table here so that we can show a real good track record for this year. My bottom line here is there's more than one kind of participant in the market, and these guys are at odds with each other, and that is contributing to volatility that we're having in rather illiquid conditions.
I just think that's a great point. Just one last thing, Vic, you'd mentioned about the dips. And here's just another chance to reiterate traders versus investors. And, you know, how I approach it is I sort of get this long-term view or this macro view. That's why, you know, I love talking to people like Kevin Muir, because I take this big picture. Then I drill down. And so, for example, crude down from $85 in October to $62 this week. Does that influence my long-term view? No, it doesn't, but it creates an opportunity. And that's why I never go all or none into the market. You know, if I wanted to invest $100, I don't throw $100 on the table. You know, I always want to keep some powder dry, have a participation, but it's a very different approach. You know, so I love it, by the way. I don't have in my own portfolio, let's call it, I don't think I've got enough silver. I think I've been too cautious. So I love a drop in silver. That kind of thing. So it's really interesting when I hear you talk, and that's why we always emphasize, what's your time frame? Are you a trader? Are you an investor?
You absolutely have to keep those things in sync. But here's a way of looking at it. I think it is really important for people to consider when you buy something instead of why you buy it. Because if you're thinking in terms of when, then, you say, timing is important. I mean, silver, for instance, I think it's down 12 of the last 14 days. We've come off from around $25.50 to $22. I mean, that's a 14% decline. I mean, if you were looking at your portfolio and you're up 14% on the year, you probably think that was a pretty decent number. So, that's why I think it is important to time. And if you're going to be a longer term investor, you don't want to just, while I'm on the phone with the broker, why don't we buy a bunch? Think a little bit more in terms of maybe stepping into it and managing your risk that way.
Well, that's why they could also go to victoradair.ca, victoradair.ca, get all of the notes because there's so much happening. See the charts there, as I say, always that picture, I think, tells a huge story, easy to grasp there. So go to victoradair.ca. And of course, you'll be seeing Victor online with us at the World Outlook Conference. And a reminder, this is the last weekend to get that 1 ounce silver coin. We did get extra. We sold out the first 100 like presto. So we do have extra, but that's it. So we have been able to get another 100 right now. So for the first 100, who sign up, we'll be able to do that. And you'll see Victor, you'll see me, all sorts of great things happening at the World Outlook Conference. Go to mikesmoneytalks.ca and book your ticket. But I love that 1 ounce silver coin. Don't you, Vic?
I have a couple of them, Mike, and I've had them for years.
There you go. victoradair.ca. Time now for this week's Goofy Award, and it is a little bit different in that it's all about saluting principle over money. The goofy part is that it's so rare. I want to give a major shout-out, though, to the Women's Tennis Association, who announced Wednesday that it's suspending its tournaments in China and Hong Kong. I mean, that's no small gesture. In 2019, they held 9 different tournaments there, including the Tour Championship. Estimates that the cancellations could cost upwards of $100 million. I mean, the players, the administrators, and everyone involved with the Women's Tennis Tour are responding to concern over the safety and well-being of former top 20 player Peng Shui, who posted a message on social media Weibo at the beginning of November, accusing a former Communist Party vice premier of sexual assault, forcing her to have sex against her will. Almost immediately, she disappeared, and her entire social media presence was erased. Well, 3 weeks later, Chinese state media released a video and photos of her in a restaurant, but the staging was obvious. Days later, she was interviewed by the head of the International Olympic Committee, Thomas Bach, who should be on everyone's shortlist of the least inquisitive minds in the world. Of course, with the Olympics months away, he's willing to play ball with the Communist Party. But there were no questions about the sexual assault, the accusations, or where she's been, or any other details. But the script is a familiar one. Threaten the person who has offended the Communist Party or Xi Jinping. At times, disappear them. Then threaten their family. They did it to Chinese doctors who tried to alert the world in December 2019 of the new coronavirus that was spreading. They were put in detention. They were threatened and then forced to withdraw their statements. The CCP did it to well-known business people like Apple Daily's Jimmy Lai, who was carted off to jail. And until the communists, by the way, shut down Apple Daily, it was Hong Kong's largest circulation English language newspaper, but it was pro-democracy. Now, being pro-democracy, by the way, can literally get you a life sentence in jail. My point, though, is people disappear or arrested as a matter of course. I mean, think about Michael Spavor, Michael Kovrig, held hostage from December 2018 to September 24th this year. And the response, though, from so many businesses, from the Canadian government or the NBA, is to kowtow to the Communist Party of China's wishes, which makes the actions of the Women's Tennis Association all the more impressive. You had star athletes like Serena Williams, Naomi Osaka. They didn't think about their shoe deals or endorsement and demanding action while fully endorsing the WTA's decision. I kind of hope somewhere LeBron James and other NBA players at least have the decency to blush. I hope all of us who cry out for leadership on the China file, all of us who are appalled by the horrendous human rights abuses, the genocide, the threats they make on Canadian soil to Canadian citizens, the direct interference in the federal election, the spying. I hope all of us will take a moment to salute everyone involved in the Women's Tennis Association who put principle over money. I'll tell you, I bet that's something Xi Jinping and the Communist Party are not used to seeing. Hey, just a reminder of the webinar, Tuesday, 9 a.m. Just go to mikesmoneytalks.ca. ADCOR will be doing it. Fascinating area for investors and for business and individuals. Plus, of course, as I had just mentioned, it's the last, well, we've got 100 more. We've got 100 extra silver coins to give away if you book your ticket to the World Outlook Conference. And take advantage because it's got to be first come, first serve. We've been told we cannot get any more and get it delivered by Christmas. So this is it. And finally, hey, just a reminder to join Money Talks tweets or Michael Campbell's Facebook. And here's the big reason. I defy you go there. You can find so many things that are not posted or not presented in the mainstream media. My goal is just to give you more facts, more research, expose you to expert opinion. I don't care what you do with it. That's your business. I just think the more rounded our decisions are, the better it is for all of us. In the meantime, I hope you have a terrific week.
This is the Money Talks podcast with Michael Campbell, available at mikesmoneytalks.ca or through your favorite podcast subscription service. Join us on Facebook at Michael Campbell's Money Talks and on Twitter at Money Talks Tweet.